This is Mae Warren. Today is the 12th of November 1996. No, the 13th. This is the 13th of November 1996. I'm in Lexington, Virginia with Ferris Hotchkiss. And my friend, yeah, I'm picking up just fine. My first question to you is a question I have never asked anyone else, Ferris. Why did you have a thick bandage around your head and have pictures of you in the yearbook?
Well, it wasn't that I was trying to be Tonto out of the Lone Ranger, although that was a nickname I picked up at about that time. No, I was driving back from Richmond, Virginia in my little 1949 two-door Plymouth, and on old Route 60, and some idiot had run out of gas in the pitch-black dark, and instead of pulling his car off the road, or instead of leaving his lights on, he did neither. He left the car partly on the road and turned his lights out because he didn't want to run his battery down. And I must admit, I probably wasn't the most alert person in the world, and I just smacked right into the back of him. So that was the end of my little Plymouth, and that was the only car that I ever had at Washington Lee. Because when I was here, cars were comparatively scarce. I would doubt that maybe a third of the student body had a car, no more than that. And one of the great games that you'd play back then, and the insurance companies would have gone berserk if they knew what was going on, was whose car could you borrow? And these parents, who probably also were oblivious to this, didn't know that all these automobiles were being driven by other people, the Hollands and Sweetbriar and Randolph-Macon. Because we generally back then, Mame, and this is a bit of an exaggeration, but generally speaking, it was kind of all business Monday through Friday. I mean, we really did. It was almost like a job. And you kind of went to work, which was class, and you did your homework and you wrote your papers. And there wasn't a great deal of foolishness until Friday after class rolled around. And then this place would erupt Friday night, most all day long Saturday, and most of the day on Sunday, with a lot of parties and a lot of good fun. And by Monday morning, though, you'd sort of go back to work again. It was, you know, Monday morning again. And we call it work hard, play hard. And it was a pretty good description of what was going on.
Now, weren't there still Saturday classes in your time?
Yeah, but Saturday classes were Saturday classes, and there was a real big difference between a Saturday morning class and any other class during the rest of the week. You'd never have a test on Saturday.
Is that true?
Or a paper due. I mean, the professors were no happier with Saturday classes than the students were. So it went Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And the Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday sequence would generally be more intense, much more intense on Tuesdays and Thursdays than on Saturdays. The kiss of death was to have what was called a 12:05 on Saturday. That was the last of the classes. There were no classes after 1 o'clock. The only thing in the afternoons back then were laboratories. So you'd live in dread of the registrar signing you up for something that puts you in a 12:05 Saturday class. And if you did, as I said, the professor was no happier with it than you were. And the classes begin at 8:25, and the last one began at 12:05, and that would be it. I remember, Maine, when I came back here on staff after a couple of years, and the faculty voted to do away with Saturday classes, and I remember so well the faculty saying, "Oh boy, that's just going to be great on Saturday mornings. Now we can be in our offices and get a lot of work done." And for about 3 Saturdays, you'd hear, those were still the days of the typewriter, you'd hear the clickety clackety, but then each Saturday it got quieter and quieter until you could shoot a cannon down the colonnade and not hit a professor or a student, for that matter, on Saturday mornings.
I'll bet. Now, you got pretty involved with publications.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I didn't know that about you. Mm-hmm. I learned a whole lot about you, Ferris.
Where did I leave all those breadcrumbs?
Well, I enjoyed it. So tell me about the Ringtone Five.
Well, we had two editions of the Ringtone Five back then, the Tuesday and the Friday edition, Tuesday and Thursday edition, with completely separate staffs. And not only did you have the fun of being a reporter or a photographer or a columnist or that kind of thing, but most of the staff would actually go to what was then the print shop, and you would help physically put the paper together. We used to set headlines with what were called sticks. You hold a stick in your hand, and you had your what's called a sort case with your individual lead letters. And if you want to do a headline, you'd pick up your letters and you'd put them in this stick until it, you know, they came out like that, and then you'd lock it in, and then you'd take it over and put it in this big frame that was what produced the paper. It was a letter press. It was not an offset press. So the idea, to a large extent, really was to engage you in journalistic kind of pursuits, and sort of as an extra fringe benefit at no extra cost, you really learned a good deal about what was letterpress printing. And it was a lot of fun. It really was. We would be down, the print shop was right where this library is now, an old cinder block building. And we'd spend hours down there. Had a great time.
Now tell me, what was fun about it?
Well, what was fun about it was there was a certain degree of competition to begin with between the two papers.
I wondered about that, between the two editions?
Yeah, and between the two editions. It wasn't liberal conservative so much as it was just picking up on some campus issue, let's say on the way in which the disciplinary system was working. There were certain things that were verboten, you just didn't question: the honor system, conventional dress, the speaking tradition, things like that. But other things that you could kind of argue about, a paper would invariably take a position on it, argue a particular point, and the other one just, I think, for the dickens of it, would take the opposite point. So there was a fun competition between the two, and there was also just the plain old competitiveness of who's going to get the story, whether the Tuesday edition is going to get it, or whether the Thursday edition, or the Friday, I can't remember,
is it Friday?
And, you know, who can get there first kind of thing. And we did all our own photography, in addition to our own writing.
And where are those pictures now?
Who knows? Have you seen the bound volumes? You've seen those, yeah. Beam, I don't know where those pictures are. I guess they probably don't exist, I would think.
Well, now how did you decide which edition to hook up with?
Well, in one of three ways. Either you really didn't care, and you would talk to the editors of the two editions, and one editor would need some help, and the other one wouldn't. I mean, it was kind of lackadaisical in that respect. Or what I think was usually more the case is that you were probably a sophomore, at least, maybe even a junior, and you had come to know one or the other editor, and or you somehow became allied a little bit more with the viewpoint of one paper versus the other, and you might say, I just like to be with that particular staff as you know them. You might have other friends who went on it. A third way, though, and what influenced so much of what went on back then, was what was called sort of fraternity succession. And a newspaper or a yearbook or a dance set or even some of the campus-wide offices would, as it was said back then, would get into a house. And it wouldn't be automatically passed down in that house. But that house, or the members of that house, had a leg up on it. I, later on in my senior year, became the editor of the Calyx. And one reason why I became editor of the Calyx is because in those days, the editorship kind of went back and forth between the Beta House and the ZBT House. That doesn't mean that it didn't sometimes change a little bit, but if you look back in the middle 50s, you'd see a preponderance of the back and forth going on between, in that particular case, the Betas and the ZBTs. There was a tremendous political organization back then, as you've probably heard, called the Big Click and the Little Click.
I was hoping you would talk about that.
And they were just like the Republicans and the Democrats. They weren't ideological at all. They were pure power politics. And the Big Click sometimes had fewer fraternities in it than the Little Click, or vice versa. But if you had the fewer fraternities at any one time, but you had been called the Big Click, you continued to be called the Big Click. It sort of gravitated to generally to what we know as the Red Square houses versus all the other ones, but not always. And what would go on is what goes on in any political world, and that is that if one of the fraternities wanted to get one of their folks elected, say, president, student body, or even an office not quite as elevated as that, and it thought it could do it by switching parties and making a deal with the party to which it switched to, in other words, get a commitment from that party to put a particular member of that fraternity in that slot, they'd do it. So there was this jockeying back and forth every year of maybe a house or two, never more than that. It was almost in balance, so it didn't take much to throw it off. But there were elections often where the clique that theoretically had the greatest number of votes still wasn't successful with a particular position, simply because there was no law against. If you were a member of the Little Clique, but you really preferred someone who was a member of a Big Clique house, you could vote for him if you wanted to, and there were people who crossed over.
So everything was secret ballot.
Oh yeah, right. But
and no one knew who the traitors were.
Exactly. Overwhelmingly, it was sort of party line voting, as much as anything. And there were offices, as I recall, we didn't, on the one hand, I don't think we elected class officers that way. I think that was just more total class voting as it is today. But in addition to the president, vice president, secretary of the student body and offices like that, we also had elected officers of what we call the dance sets. We had four of them, so each of those had a president, and that was very political, perhaps even more political than the student government offices.
Why was that?
Oh, because you didn't have to take it as seriously. I mean, you didn't really have to worry as much about whether someone was really going to be a good spring dance president as you did whether that person would be a good student body president.
Okay, so what did it mean to be a spring dance president? You were the finals president.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, if you were the president of a dance set, it was your responsibility to, first of all, to gather probably about 6 to 10 vice presidents of the dance set, so that you'd form a group of people that usually numbered somewhere between 10 to a dozen people, something of that in that rough order. And you collectively would decide on a theme for the dance, you know, whether it was going to be Las Vegas or King Arthur or what have you. All of our dance sets always had themes. And
okay, so just any dance set, not just fancy dress.
Oh, no, all four of them. Now, the only fancy dress was costumed. My dance set, for instance, the theme that I and my vice presidents put together was Tea House of the August Moon, which was a popular musical back then. And what you do in those days is that after you decided on your theme, then your attention would be turned to the decorations, how you're going to decorate. And the way we decorated was in the old Doremus Gym. We didn't have Warner Center. And what you would do is you would cover up every blessed square inch of that gymnasium with paper. I mean, the fire marshals back then must have been asleep, because I can't imagine getting away with it. Well, what we do is you've been in the old gym. We bought, I don't know where they came from, we bought these huge rolls of paper that if you stood the roll up on end was just about as tall as that distance between the bottom of the running track and the floor. And you would simply wrap up the gymnasium, cover it up completely, just like you're wrapping a Christmas present. And we had a black cloth ceiling that we would suspend between the rails of the track, so that when we finished with it and walked in the Doremus, it looked like a really nice room. It didn't look like a gymnasium. And you would then you'd paint this paper based on the theme. And if you wanted to, you could have some freestanding things in the middle. I think we had a little bridge going over a pond. But maybe I'll never forget it. As long as I live, I think the greatest moment of stark terror I have ever had in my whole life, believe it or not, was we were painting the things for the finals dance set. And as I recall, we had to paint all this paper that we're hanging up a light blue to get it so it wasn't white. And we figured out somewhere along the line that it would take us utterly forever to paint all that much paper with a paintbrush or paint brushes. So we went to the paint store and rented a spray painter. And we were painting along and getting a job done pretty fast, when all of a sudden Norm Lord, who was, you know Norm, he walked in there and he said, "My God, Hotchkiss!" And I froze in my tracks. As I recall, I was sort of over like this. And he said, "Look what you've done." And I turned around and Maine, the entire gymnasium floor behind me was blue. And I for a moment there, for more than a moment, what I thought I had done was spilled wet blue paint on the gym floor. Well, fortunately, the only reason why I'm probably here today and still alive is that what was happening was that there was just enough of a draft in the gym to pick up this spray. But fortunately, by the time it fell on the floor, way down there, it had dried completely. And you could just brush it off, you know, with a broom. But at any rate,
a career almost dashed
an education almost dashed. That would have, can you imagine? But anyway, so the dance sets were all thematic, and they would always start on Friday nights. You'd have a concert, and it wouldn't be a dance. It would be just a come listen to the music. My wonderful music was Count Basie. I just never will forget that. And so you'd come hear Count Basie and just sit and listen on Friday night, and then on Saturday night would be the dance. And it was only costumes and fancy dress, but otherwise it was, you know, tuxedos and all the other three.
So the gym was full of chairs for the concert, and then the chairs were removed?
Yeah. Chairs were taken out. They were set up auditorium style on Friday night and then removed. Now, except, speaking of chairs, we would put some chairs kind of around the perimeter, and then always under what would be the east basket, which would have been hauled up out of sight, was always what students today wouldn't know what in the world it was what was called a chaperone's box. And in the chaperone's box would be the assorted deans and faculty who were keeping an eye on us. And usually, MAME, these dances would begin with a grand march. And you would come in with your date, and you would walk the length of the gymnasium and bow or curtsy in front of the chaperone box, and then disperse. And that was the thing to do back then. And I can just imagine how utterly and completely bored those poor chaperones must have been, and how, on the other hand, completely unconcerned and totally oblivious we were to the fact they were even around. But there wasn't really much going on up there except dancing. And in those days, that meant usually that you didn't stay terribly long, because no one really wanted to be up there in their dinner jackets and long dresses dancing terribly long. Then you'd take your date back to one of the houses in town where dates stayed in those days, and you'd change into Bermuda shorts and blue jeans and things like that, and go down to the Beta House or the Phi Delta House or one of those places for the rest of the evening. So the dances sometimes weren't terribly well attended all evening long. They tended to have kind of an initial rush of people, and after that they thinned out fairly quickly. Except for fancy dress. And because fancy dress was so fancy, and you'd spent so darn much money on these costumes, and they were hard to get off and get into Bermuda shorts from, so generally you'd stay down there. One of the great little funny things about fancy dress was, and Judy remembers it, every time she thinks of it, her face gets scarlet red, is that in order for these costumes to fit, you had to ask your date what her measurements were. And the great fun was whether your date was really telling you the truth or not. And when these measurements would come up from Judy and others at these girls' schools, Judy claims that the measurements that she sent for her fancy dress were correct. No padding or anything. But it was a lot of fun. It was great.
Do I take it the dress didn't quite fit right?
No, it did.
Oh, it did?
No, it did. Oh. Yeah. No, it did.
Just the thought of giving the measurements?
Exactly. I think just revealing anything like that was something that was I doubt if any of those young ladies had ever been asked what their measurements were.
Well, believe it or not, I've actually seen one of the letters where a young lady, sent her measurements.
Is that right?
Yes, I found one of those, which I think is a real treasure.
Yeah,
I was
real
excited to find that.
It is.
Now, you mentioned Count Basie.
Uh-huh.
Now, who would play at the dance? And Count Basie was the concert.
It'd be two nights.
Would he play?
He'd play at the dance as well.
And people would leave with Count Basie playing?
Yeah, they really would, Mame, as inexplicable as that sounds. Now, I don't mean that the place was ever empty, but generally speaking, there was kind of a rush of people at the very beginning of the evening. But by, let's call it, the middle of the evening, it thinned out pretty quickly. And what you surmise is correct. It was probably a poor use of a lot of money for the second half of the dance, because people, as I said, would gravitate back. See, the thing was in those days that your dates had to be in. They had to be back home by midnight. And so the dances, as I recall, began at 8. So if you were going to have anything to drink, I mean, just to be blunt about it, and not stand around in your tuxedo all night long, generally speaking, after you'd been at the dance for a couple of hours or so, you'd go on back to the house. But they never emptied out entirely.
Okay, I've got a logistical question for you. We're talking the 50s here.
Mm-hmm.
Where did Count Basie stay? He stayed overnight in Lexington.
Oh, that's a good question, Mame. And the best I can do to answer that is that there was a motel, not in Lexington. It was on Route 11, and as I recall, it was somewhere kind of up near Stanton that you know, allowed black people to stay there? That's a very good question. I don't exactly know the answer, but I think that's what was going on.
Because who would take care of the logistics of something like that?
Well, you had what was called the dance board. Now, I didn't have anything to say much or hardly at all about who was going to play at what turned out to be finals dance, because by the time the elections were held and all that, Count Basie had been lined up long ahead. I mean, you had to
So it wasn't your choice.
No. Mm-hmm. You had to book these people, you know, way ahead of time. Mm-hmm. So I guess basically those arrangements were made by the dance board, which was a separate group of students. And there was a wonderful man who you may not have you anyone ever mentioned Sam Rader to you?
Yes, Frank has.
Yeah, well,
he's
Sam,
a banker?
He was a banker. Uh-huh. He was the head of what's now Crestar Bank. And Sam Rader, purely out of the good of his heart, just as a volunteer, was kind of the advisor, if you want to think of that. Think of it that way, of the dances. And I can see him as clear as day, because you had to pay to go to these dances. And either you bought your season ticket for all four of them, or you could pay at the door. And Sam Rader would sit there at his little table, and he always had a little cigar in his mouth that was not lit. He'd just eat it up slowly. And he'd sit there and either take your ticket or sell you a ticket to get into the dances. But he also, I think, helped the dance board out of some tight spots sometime when they got into squabbles with contracts and things of that nature with the bands.
Is he still alive?
He is still alive.
That's what I thought.
Still alive.
Yeah,
he's
go
90.
Talk to him.
Yeah, he's 90 some odd years old. He lives right over there next to Waddell School, the elementary school.
But he's not an alum, is he? I don't think he is. I think Frank just thought he'd be a real interesting person to talk to.
Well, he was, you know, I'm not sure. He was very closely associated with the Sigma Chi house, because the Sigma Chis wanted to have the house that we call the Mattingly House name for Sam Rader. Now, whether he was just a Sigma Chi somewhere else or whether he was a W&L Sigma Chi, I think you're probably right. I think he probably didn't go here, although I don't know why I say that.
I'm going to check into him for another reason. I've got something, I'm looking for someone that age. But who else in your 4 years here, and actually more than your 4 years here, what other big entertainers have you seen here?
Well, the biggest of them all was when Louis Armstrong was here. Louis Armstrong was here for Fancy Dress in either my sophomore or junior year, forget which. And the Louis Armstrong concert was just absolutely packed. Again, the fire marshal must have been asleep. You've heard the expression hanging from the rafters. There were people literally sitting on the rafters of the gymnasium. I don't remember this minute why that false ceiling hadn't been put in there. But anyway, I can remember people dangling from those rafters listening to that guy, and he was just absolutely magic. But Guy Lombardo's band, although it by that time it had been adulterated somewhat, was here. The successor to Glenn Miller band was here. Lester Lannan came a number of times. The band that plays the A-Train, whatever their name is, can't remember their name, but they were here. I mean, those were the days when Washington Lee dance sets, as we call them, were big deals insofar as these bands were concerned. And they were, the bands themselves, I think unlike today, a lot of their bread and butter was the college circuit. And it was very definitely, and now that I remember, it was very definitely a circuit, because you'd sort of be able to get Louis Armstrong, because he could be at Virginia, and then W&L, and then I don't know where he'd go, maybe the University of North Carolina, you know, maybe Duke, Vanderbilt. And I mean, their agents would kind of line you up, and that's part of the way that, now what they did during the middle of the week, I don't know, maybe they didn't do anything. But we had the biggest names in music here. We didn't, that's the only kind of music we had, though, because when I was a student here, if you were interested in symphonic music or opera or any sort of instrumental performance, there just was none. I can remember, and I didn't do this, but twice in the whole 4 years I was here, but if you wanted to hear any symphonic music, you had to go to Lynchburg or to E.C. Glass High School, because there wasn't any in Lexington. I don't think there was any in Roanoke that I can recall. And it was only one of the differences back then, Mame, that I wish was the case today, was that the law students were very much a part of the overall student body. And since the university had no dining facilities, if you can believe that, here's a university that doesn't feed its students. But it didn't. And so either you had to belong to a fraternity to eat, or you had to get a meal ticket in what was called the Dutch Inn, which is right here on Washington Street, or a meal ticket at the Southern Inn. And so when you went down to dinner at night and whatnot at the Beta House, for instance, in my case, there would be probably 7, 8, or 9 law students who were eating down there, and they exerted a somewhat more mature influence over the house. And for instance, what brought that thought to mind was is that if anybody, let's say, was getting together what was called a team to go hear the Philadelphia Orchestra or something like that that used to travel in those days, it would usually be one of the older law students who'd take that initiative. We have an emeritus trustee whose name is Dick Haynes down in Dallas, Texas, who was a very influential law student during my undergraduate days. And Dick would gather us younger guys together and say, look, fellas, it's time for you all to get a little culture, and I'm going to take you over to Lynchburg so you can hear Beethoven's Fifth or something like that. And it was good for us, and we really profited from that kind of influence. And I wish that the fraternities had that influence now, because you don't ever see a law student much in a fraternity house anymore.
Yeah, I don't see them on this side of the street much.
No, they stay on that side of the ravine. Yeah, that's probably co-education and the law school moving over to where it is now, undoubtedly during my time here, are the two largest and most significant educational or academic alterations of the student body. And of course, one came long before the other. The law students got over there in 1976. But as soon as that happened, a personality that this campus had disappeared just overnight. It was gone. And when the law school was in Tucker Hall, even long after we had dining facilities and all the rest, you still had these law students who were not always paragons of perfect proportions, but they were invariably older and as I said, more mature, and they were around. You know, you'd see them at the co-op, you'd see them in the library, you'd see them in the fraternity houses, and we've lost that.
Was that loss foreseen?
Did people
realize that was going to happen?
Well, I guess we should have figured that out. but I can't say that I really recall any specific conversation about it. And one reason why there may not have been is that there really wasn't an alternative, because the idea was to double the size of the law school, and you simply couldn't add on to Tucker Hall in any kind of satisfactory way to double the size of the law school. We hadn't begun planning the library, the Leyburn Library, yet. I guess the law school could have been built like this building is built. I guess this could be the law school, and I guess there could be another one of these buildings like this, you know, on around the ravine behind Reed Hall a little bit. But because of its size, it went across that ravine quickly. And I would say, probably, Mame, to your question, that we didn't really anticipate the division that was going to bring about. And it's getting worse and worse. I mean, it's now the law school is not only divided, but now there are comparatively few Washington Lee undergraduates in the law school. So that place is made up 90% of people who have their undergraduate degrees from other places. And now that they're becoming alumni, they have far different attitudes about what they want in the way of alumni services. And I'm not being critical, it's just different, that's all. My daughter is a fairly good example of that. She is a lawyer from here. She's down in Charlotte, North Carolina, and she complains to me every once in a while that when alumni gatherings and events and plans are made in Charlotte, they're always undergraduate in their focus. And so it's something we have to pay a lot of attention to now. And of course, coeducation is, don't have to say much about that. That was the other big one.
We definitely need to talk about that, but let's save that. Let's make that leap back to student days, because we're getting really good stuff here. We were talking about entertainers. Mm-hmm. Now, this gentleman doesn't fall in the category of entertainers, but he certainly was a big name. You were here when Arnold Toynbee was here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
That was just electric. And I can say that name from a person, a former student who was not, and I'm sorry about this now, but I was not nearly as aware of what was available to me with Arnold Toynbee being here as I should have been. I wasn't a particularly inquisitive student. I always was much more interested in extracurricular activities and things like that. So I didn't take his course as I could have. But I did go to all of his public lectures, and just to have a mountain of a man here, whether you were taking his courses or not, hardly made any difference. All he had to do was walk down the colonnade, and the place, you could just feel the pride and the awe of having a person of his stature on this campus. And he was well aware of that, and he played to it, and he was very gracious. Ann Farrah, Jimmy Farrah's mother, was his secretary during that time, and she knew this place frontwards and backwards, and she did a wonderful job sort of steering him around so that he was seen, you know, by a lot of students who wouldn't have a chance to ever have contact with a man of that sort. But I remember his public lectures were always done at Lee Chapel. And the one I remember the best, in fact, the only one I really frankly remember what he said precisely, was at the very end. He told us that it was, of course, in the late 50s, and people who were bright like he was they were seeing the handwriting on the wall with the Russians. But he stood up there in Lee Chapel that last lecture, and he said, "Gentlemen," he said, "the world is concerned about Russia and China, as well it should be, But he said, let me give you the advice of an old man. He said, never, ever, ever turn your backs on the Germans. Now, fortunately, so far, some 40-odd years later, he was wrong about that. But that had a very chilling effect, because after all, there were still veterans on this campus at that time who had fought in the Second World War. And he was obviously very much influenced by the Second World War himself. But we've never maimed had anything like it since. And if I had $1 zillion, what I'd do is I'd give Washington Lee $1 zillion specifically for the purpose of bringing here, maybe not every year, because I think you could wear it out a little bit, but every 3 or 4 years, some real giant, you know, somebody who really was world class.
Do you know how it came to be that he was here?
There was a professor here named Edward Myers. I think it's Edward. Anyway, he was a professor of philosophy, and he had gotten to know Toynbee when he, Myers, was at Oxford. How exactly he did, I don't know, but at any rate, it was through their friendship that he suggested to Toynbee that he come here. He told Toynbee he thought he'd enjoy a place like Washington Lee. And so it was a connection. I mean, I'm not sure we could have gotten him if we had simply set our sail for him without any connection to help us out.
It's that old WNL network.
It is, yeah. It is that.
Now, he was clearly a giant on the world stage.
Mm-hmm.
But you were here at the time. Well, it seems like there's always giants at Washington and Lee. Were there any faculty members who made a big difference to you?
Yeah, of course, there were a number of faculty members who made a huge difference to me just because they were wonderful people, not because they had any particular national presence. John Gunn, who you may have met, who's still around, certainly did. We had some wonderful fellows in the economics department. One professor whose name was Blackjack Behrman. Blackjack told us, he said, gentlemen, I usually have 10 questions on my quizzes, and he said it doesn't take any leap of brilliance to figure out they're probably each worth 10 points. And he said, but what I want you to understand is that if you know the answer, or you think you know the answer, you'll get 10 points if you get it right, or you may get fewer if you're on the right track. But if you don't know the answer and you just think that you can write something and keep me going, he said, I'm going to take off double. And no one thought he would do that until the first time we started getting minus papers back. You know, you'd get back a minus 10 or something like that. But the guy who was kind of fascinating back then was a man whose name was Harvey Wheeler. You may remember a book named Fail Safe. Very popular book back in the early 60s. It was one of those nuclear bomber books. And Harvey Wheeler was the author of that book. And so he was kind of somebody, probably of the same kind of glamour on the campus as this fellow Larry Watkin probably was long, long before I ever got here, who was the guy who lived in Castle Hill, as a matter of fact, up there, and went out and became one of Disney's chief scriptwriters for a long, long time. And he wrote a lot of books that are in this library. But
what was the person's name who wrote Failsafe?
Harvey Wheeler.
Harvey Wheeler. What did he teach?
Political science.
I hadn't heard that.
And he was, and he left and went out to California, and last I heard of him, he was associated with some think tank out there. But the faculty back then were lots of just plain old characters, maybe. I mean, most of us had nicknames for the faculty, like Eddie the Axe, that was Ed Atwood, and Blackjack Behrman, and Snortin' Morton, and people, you know, Sleepy Williams, and folks like that. There was a math professor named Felix Welch, and he was the leader of and almost the sole member of the Lexington Polar Bear Club. And what Felix used to love to do was to go out in the Maury River in the wintertime and break the ice and jump in naked. And but he was a brilliant mathematician, but a real kick otherwise. And one of the things that he'd do once in a while, though not very often, so I don't mean to blow this out of proportion, but once in a while on one of those famous Saturday morning classes, and particularly after what he perceived to be probably a rough Friday night, he would walk into class with these little glasses of tomato juice for us in class. And, you know, those were days when you could do that kind of thing. It should have been absolutely disallowed. I mean, I can't imagine letting a professor do that, but he did. He got away with it. I think back then professors had, I'd hate to be quoted on this, but I think they had more individualistic personalities. It's almost as if they worked at it. There was a guy who's...
Hold on, I need to type the paper.